Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. Now, today we are going to be talking about food. So you might enjoy this with a bit of a scone or a toast or a flapjack. We're mad for flapjacks in my house at the moment. You know, getting all this back to school action going on and batch cooking, and I'll see how long that lasts. And even though these flapjacks that we love are healthy ones by Susan Jane White, they are still delicious. Some things actually manage to be healthy and delicious, and that's those flapjacks that Susan Jane makes. Now, we are talking about food because the Taste of Dublin is back. That's that celebration of all things foodie back in the Ivy Gardens. And it is like a bit of a harbinger of joy. The first of many events that are going to start coming back as the great reopening continues. Micheál Martin certainly seems very chipper about it all, even if we have to see what happens with schools reopening. Ours went back to school this week, and we have to think about the Delta variant and ventilation in classrooms and all the things we talked about on the podcast last week. But people are, I suppose, cautiously optimistic, and we have to remain like that. It possibly is the beginning of the end, but the way the twists and turns in the past 18 months have been, you know, incredible. So we can't really be completely we can't have complete peace of mind, I suppose. Now, we're going to get to the Taste of Dublin later on, but I wanted to bring you a couple of stories about women this week. The Paralympics continues, as do the medals which have been coming in, and brilliant coverage by Joanne O'Riordan, who's an Irish Times sports writer. Keep an eye out for her on RTE. She's playing a blinder. And staying with sport, some great news that the Ireland women's and men's international teams are to receive equal pay for the first time after an historic agreement. The men's squad have agreed to reduce their international fees, with the FAI matching their contribution to ensure that the senior women's team match fee is increased, and all male and female players now receive the same pay from the September international window onwards. So it was some great news. Although I did see someone on Twitter saying that an RTE presenter had then said to the women, "Now you'll have to deliver now," which I don't really think is appropriate, because no one says that to the men. But anyway, apart from that, it's great news that the equal pay for the women in football, and the women's team are due to open their World Cup qualifying campaign on September 17th with an away to Georgia, while the men's team open their three-game international window away to Portugal on Wednesday, and they'll all be earning the same money for the first time. So a bit of good news. Now, I mentioned in the last episode that we're preparing to do an episode on Afghanistan and how women there are being treated by the Taliban. And the latest on that is that the Taliban have decided Afghan women will be allowed to study at universities, which is so great of them, but they cannot be in the same room as men and will not be taught by male teachers. The Taliban's acting higher education minister announced, as the world waited the new rules under the extremist regime that is expected to curb women's rights. So all of that continues to be very depressing, and we can't let this story slide, or we can't lose sight of it. So we will be bringing you some voices from Kabul, hopefully in a few weeks. So do stay tuned for that. But today it's all about the Taste of Dublin, which is a celebration of eating, drinking and entertainment all in one place, which just sounds very old fashioned because we haven't done it for so long. Taste of Dublin is back. Savour the moment is the theme for this year's event. It's returning to the stunning Ivy Gardens from the 1st to the 5th of September 2021. If you want to find out more about it, go to dublin.tastefestivals.com. And this is midway through the festival. That's where we are. And we wanted to talk to some people who are involved. So we've gathered Ellie Kisiumbi, Michelle Darmody and Aoife Noonan. Ellie is from Malawi. She arrived in Ireland 10 years ago. She trained at the Ballymaloe Cookery School, and she also has her own food business, Ellie's Kitchen, selling hot sauces and pasta sauces. And she recently announced on Twitter that she's been accepted onto the 2021 Food Academy programme. Michelle Darmody is a weekly food writer with the Irish Examiner and the author of the Cake Cafe Bake Book, And together with Ellie Kisiombi, she started Our Table to raise awareness of the plight of people in direct provision through food. And finally, Aoife Noonan is a multi-award winning pastry chef from Dublin and food writer for the Irish Times. She started her own business in 2021, offering online masterclasses in all things sweet. And she's also released limited edition monthly patisserie lines, drawing on her experience working in fine dining kitchens. Now, they are all involved in one way or another with Taste of Dublin. So I began by asking Ellie Kisiombi how excited she is to be involved in one of the first events to be open to the public since the pandemic took it all away.
Yes, I'm super excited. So
We're all excited. Real life things. Bring it on.
Yes. So Our Table came about between me and Michelle. So we co-founded Our Table the late 2014, if I'm not wrong. That's when me and Michelle, we met. At that time, I was volunteering with Irish Refugee Council. And at that time, my then boss, you know, told me that, because I was volunteering there as a volunteer campaign director for indirect provision. So I have done a lot of work with Irish Refugee Council. And at the very same time, you know, like within my volunteership, it's when I met Michelle through my boss, then Sue Conlan. So then she said to me, like, oh, we've been approached by this lady. She seemed really nice. She's a business lady. And we just felt like you are the right person for you to take that project with her. And I was like, okay, let me meet her. And then 2 days later, Michelle came over. She brought a chocolate cake. And she was wearing a kind of like an African wrap, because I don't see that with many white women. So, like, wearing a headband. And then we sat down, we started talking, and we just talked as if we were met before. And then we talked about food, and she talked to me what she wanted to do. And yeah, that was our first. We shared the cake, and then we left each other. And then after that, she followed up, and I was like, oh, this lady, she's serious. And even I myself, I was super excited, because it wasn't just only that I've met somebody who is a foodie that wanted to actually, at that time, there was a lot to that, because at that time, this system was kind of like a little broken system. The asylum system was kind of like a little broken system. And it needed a soft campaign. It needed a campaign that we could relate to the public and people could understand what exactly, you know, like direct provision is, and why are we going out in the streets and campaigning that this system is not right. You know, we need a better system for people that are coming here to seek sanctuary. So I think with food, it actually relates really well, because, you know, like food connects people. Food makes people to talk. I know there is love in food. There is so much that food can come about with. So anyway, that's where Our Table came about. So we started like Michelle, she could drive us, because, you know, at that time she was still also running her businesses, and, you know, like she knew people in business, so she could find us a space, and I could coordinate women and men from direct provision, and we go into these community kitchens and make food and invite people. And then people were like, oh, you know, the food is great, why can't you do something and all of that? And then, you know, we sit down and Michelle was like, oh, why can't we do a pop-up? And I was like, yeah, that's really good. So we did our first pop-up cafe in the Project Art Center. That was about 2 days, and, you know, like it was a massive success, and we had a lot of people. Between those 2 days, we fed over 700 people, like combining the same day. We had lots of food, we had lots of people. We have doctors, academics, you know, like celebrities, people just kind of like come and wants to understand what direct provision is, and also people related to the food culture, and people wanted to see other cultures, and they listened to our stories really better. And that was our start. And then from there, we were like everywhere. And then we kind of like got a high media exposure. And from then, it's when in 2016, we had done a lot of events, because we can't go one by one, because Our Table has actually we've been very, very successful in terms of like reaching out to the community with our message. So we've done loads of stuff.
I'm going to bring Michelle in here, because it's interesting. It seems from your story about how, you know, when two people meet that are just meant to meet, it feels like. And Michelle, I think it's really hilarious, you turning up to meet Ellie with your African wrap on your head, and Ellie finding that interesting.
I don't remember having a wrap on my head.
Well, she, but I do, she, you I do remember certainly made the chocolate an impression.
Cake. I was catering a lot, so you do wear kind of hairbands to keep your hair back. And I adore African patterns, so it probably was.
No, don't worry, Michelle. I wasn't accusing you of cultural appropriation or anything. I was just saying it's interesting for, you know, it's a lovely thing that Ellie obviously noticed because it meant a lot or something. But where were you coming from? Because Ellie's talking about direct provision, a system that, you know, for a long time people weren't really aware. And I think because of the work you two have done, we're much more aware of direct provision, and other people have done work on it as well. And I think there's a real movement now to handle this whole system better. But back in 2014, where were you coming from on it?
I'd heard about the system, and I was outraged, I suppose, hearing at how little support people were given financially. And people were given so little money to kind of survive week to week. But also, it just really resonated to me, the idea of not being allowed to cook. People are very able, they weren't allowed to cook. And just the idea, I grew up in a family where food was just central to the kitchen. We all sat around the table every day for dinner, for breakfast. My mom would have baked bread. Like, I just grew up in a family that was surrounded by food. And just the idea that that was stolen from other families just really, really resonated with me and really upset me, and kind of felt, you know, this is in our name. This is in the name of every Irish person. We pay taxes. And unfortunately, that's what's supporting the system. And I was just outraged, I suppose. So having run a food business and, you know, having, like Ellie said, the kind of connections within that sphere, I just really focused in on the fact that people weren't allowed to cook, and approached Sue, who was then running the Refugee Council, and just said to her, listen, if there's anything I can do to help, I'd love to put my energy or my knowledge into that. And then myself and Ellie met, and we started looking. And one of my main aims was definitely to draw attention, to provide a cooking space, 100%, provide a cooking space for people we can share. I mean, people don't even speak the same language. You can all communicate over food. You know, we're all chopping away. We're all sharing things. We're all kind of indicating to each other what tastes good and, you know, what salt needs to be added. So there was a real kind of sense of community within the cooking space. But also just then, as we went on, was more conversations and a lot of tears. It was very emotive for some people who hadn't been able to cook for so long. You know, I literally went out with a friend, Fiona Corbett, myself went out and just bought big bags of ingredients, a lot of African ingredients and different things. And we just laid them on the table and everyone cooked and shared and ate and talked after the meal. It was just a really, really beautiful space. And then as we talked more, we realized we wanted to do something more public facing. And then that was the kind of idea. It was like, we really need to draw attention to this. And food, as Ellie said, is a soft story in a way. You know, we knew we could get into the feature pages of the weekend magazines with a food story about direct provision much more than we could with a hard sell of, you know, end direct provision. It's a different type of story in the media. So we then started approaching journalists and talking to different people and creating, like Ellie said, the pop-ups and doing more forward-facing things and drawing attention to that. And we got unbelievable support. And I think there was an awful lot of people in society who did know about direct provision and didn't know how to help or didn't know how to interact with people, didn't know what they could do, felt a little bit helpless. So us providing a space where you could come, you could share a meal, you could eat. It was the first pop-up we did was very much donation-based. So people just left what they wanted. And they just came and offered support. So there was a huge amount of people from the wider Irish community just going, hi, you know, I want to share a meal with you. I'm here if you need something, or here's some money towards, you know, support. And what we used that money for then was to buy like Leap cards and basically phone cards for people. People in direct provision aren't allowed work, or they weren't allowed work at that time. It's changed slightly since, not fully, but slightly. So we would use that mainly phone. It's amazing how much phone credit is used when you're ringing home to different people. Leap cards and some vouchers then for people to buy, you know, things like sanitary products, cosmetic products and things like that. So we'd give little all for one vouchers that people were able to use. So it was just a very much grassroots, helping, very much community led, and loads of different people from Direct Provision came, and I, you know, was still good friends with a lot of people that I met through our table, as is Ellie, and there's a lot of, you know, lingering relationships from it that I really value, actually.
Yeah. Like I say, a fantastic synergy between the two of you. Ellie, just coming back to you, I mean, you came to Ireland 10 years ago, you were in direct provision yourself. How do you see now the conversation around direct provision has changed, or even, you know, the prospects and people being much more aware of it as an issue?
Yeah, you know, and also I just want to interrupt Michelle a little bit that when we were studying our table, like, we were getting €19.10 a week. So like everything, how we started, like all this, what is talking, like when people were supporting us with financial donations and all of that, it kind of like really helped people a lot, because that was like one of the lowest support that people were getting in direct provision. So anyway, in terms of like how the conversation has changed demographically around direct provision, you know, like I mean, change doesn't happen oftenly. You know, like there is a little movement, and we have to appreciate that, because like considering where I came from here and how the system was to see where we are right now and what I've actually seen, I have to say that, you know, like there is a lot of change, and people have actually listened. And also of recently, I think because of like of coming of a lot of movements like Black Lives Matter, and you know, like you know, diversity and all of that, there is also kind of like a loss of, you know, like direct provision message. It's kind of like, you know, like people are now forgetting, you know, like that we had this message. And my fear is like, if we are not careful, we can actually lost ourselves and even go 20 years back. And that's why I'm still here. I got my papers, and people like used to come to me and like, oh, why are you always still doing this? Why do you want to go on? I'm like, okay, direct provision is still there. You know, like there is little change. The government is changing, but it's slowly. And if we can decide like to keep quiet and not do something about it, that means I've not done my work, because my work was to see this campaign going. So yeah, there is slightly changes, but I think there is also a lot of work that needs to be done so that we cannot get lost in the way.
Yeah, that's very well put. And I think, yeah, it's great to have that focus on diversity and the focus on Black Lives Matter and everything. But we need to keep all of the things in focus and make sure we don't lose sight of really important issues like how we treat people who come here for asylum, as you did. But tell us about Taste of Dublin. What are you guys going to be doing that? And then I'm going to bring Aoife Noonan in too, who's also going to be doing stuff there. But how excited are you about Taste of Dublin, Ellie?
Yes, it's my first one. It's my first one. And after the whole, you know, dragging, you know, how can I explain them? The past 2 years that we've actually been, you know, and for us to be here not being a statistics and going to Taste of Dublin, I'm bringing six vendors and 10 people, all of them from a refugee and a migrant background. And out of that, we are actually supporting to exhibit one business, which is a woman that she's been in direct provision. She's a very good cake maker. And, you know, like we managed to get her a job through our table, connecting her to one of the bakery, the bakeries, and she's working in that. And also it is like my duty to actually make sure that what I've actually been experienced, the goodwill from the people that have actually showed me, people like Michelle, people like Darina, and now we've actually just got us a donor. We can't name him because we have not finalized everything, but all of these people to actually see all of this good work and feeling like there is a need to support the journey of our table, you know, like where me and Michelle, we started. I want to actually set up this woman into her small business, wherever she can start from, but also that she has to get somewhere. So there is loads of stuff going, and I'm really, really super excited. And I can't wait to go and see how Taste of Dublin looks like.
I know. And Michelle, just quickly for you, what are you hoping will come out of our table at Taste of Dublin? And are you excited as well?
I'm excited. Ellie runs our table much more so than I do these days, so she's much more in tune with what's happening from that point of view. I'll be involved in Taste of Dublin talking as well some of the other evenings and talking about Irish food producers and food. Ellie will be organising all the our table stuff. So I've just recently had a babby, so I'm taking a back seat, but I'll be coming on to Taste of Dublin, which I'm really excited about as well, to give a few talks.
Well, I just love wandering around and tasting all the food. That's my favourite thing about Taste of Dublin. Speaking of which, Aoife Noonan, Irish Times food writer, you are going to have a patisserie workshop at Taste of Dublin. So, I mean, I think excited, I keep saying it, but it's just have real life experiences, and food is something that you want to share with people, and you can't do it on Zoom. I mean, people have tried, but it just doesn't come across as well, I suppose. So what are you going to be doing at Taste of Dublin?
So I'm doing a demo at Taste of Dublin on the Sunday, and this will be my, I think, fourth year at Taste. Now, last year it was cancelled due to the pandemic, but it's back this year. And I think it's just a really great way for people to just come together and celebrate everything, you know, that we are about and Irish food. There's so many great chefs, newer kind of up and coming chefs that are, you know, doing demonstrations. So it's great for kind of younger chefs and I suppose like maybe chefs that haven't, you know, had the limelight or anything before, to, you know, to show people what they can do. So I'm doing a demo, and it's all things pastry. I think I'm just, my name is Evening in Pastry at this point. So I'm going back to my roots, I suppose, with classical French patisserie. And I'm going to be making, it's a chocolate puff pastry kind of box. It's like a 3D like cube. I haven't figured out all of the logistics yet, but basically it's going to be filled with chocolate, cherry, and this lovely Middle Eastern spice called maleb, which is made from ground down Mediterranean cherry stones. And it's a really bitter, bitter almond kind of spice, and it just really goes well with the cherry. So I suppose it's a Black Forest kind of take on a chocolate dessert. And I suppose it's something that maybe people haven't seen. And that's what I love. I love that whole, you know, interaction with demonstrations and teaching. And you definitely don't get that on Zoom, and you don't get that really, I suppose, working in restaurants. There's, you know, behind the scenes, back of house as a chef, you don't get to meet who you're cooking for, you know. So I suppose it's great to kind of break down those walls and kind of see people face to face and just chat about food.
You've had a very interesting couple of years, because you did have a head pastry chef position, and you left that to explore other things. I mean, it's kind of sometimes when you're in a really good, safe job, you know, to go out there and do other things, that's scary. But how have you found it?
It's terrifying. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. Like, you know, I was lucky. I had some really, really great jobs, and I learned so much working in various restaurants. And I think I got to the point where maybe I wanted to push myself a little bit more, but I didn't know if I could do that within the restaurant industry. Here, maybe, I don't know. I did take a bit of time to explore kind of other avenues and, you know, work in kind of different areas of food, you know, recipe development or, you know, different kind of roles. And I got to a kind of point where, you know, I was like, this isn't for me anymore. I had a bit of a breakdown. Like, I just was very lost. And I just thought, you know what, my life is food, but I want to learn more. So I decided to go back to college, and I'm in the middle of doing a master's degree actually at the moment in nutrition, which is obviously nothing to do with patisserie or sugar or pastry. But it's something I've been interested in for a number of years. And it's something I kind of wanted to expand, I suppose, my knowledge in and learn about. So I'm doing that. But I suppose, like, yeah, going from working in, well, I wouldn't say they were comfortable jobs. I mean, there was stress, there was pressure.
Yeah, I mean, no restaurant job is comfortable or safe or anything like that. And they're bloody tough and hard jobs, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a, you know, that kind of stressful environment. And I think restaurant kitchens, they do get a bit of a bad rep. But I mean, obviously they're really enjoyable, and, you know, there's nothing comes close to a service, you know, and that adrenaline rush you get with your team. I think, yeah, leaving kitchens, I mean, I wouldn't say I've left kitchens permanently, but I suppose I've gone out and started a business on my own, and that in itself was terrifying, you know. I just need to keep, like, me personally, I just always not want more, but I want to push myself and kind of do better and, you know, better myself and learn more. So that's where I'm at the moment.
Yeah, I think when people think about pastry, I mean, it is such an incredibly complex, almost scientific type of thing that you do, and quite difficult. But I think to all of you, because I know you don't run Cake Cafe anymore, Michelle, but obviously you were a cake person for a long time. Can you all tell us what you think is a good place to start if people feel a bit afraid of the whole pastry thing but want to make really nice stuff? Where can they start that would be a good place that won't feel too much of a mountain to climb?
I think some of the Irish, traditional Irish recipes are great, like scones, brown bread, things like that. Tarts, you know, they're, what Aoife's talking about, that sounds amazing, and you do not take that over Zoom. And then the technical know-how that Aoife has, it will, like, that is an absolute showcase to make a cube of puff pastry and chocolate. Just, it sounds delicious. But for people at home, I'd imagine some of the simpler recipes. I mean, I just love a sponge cake. The idea that three ingredients, just eggs, flour, and, you know, sugar, you can just make this wonderful cake, a bit of cream and jam, you know. So I think sometimes the simple ones are kind of the good step in. And then once you get some recipes down, get your ratios right, get your temperatures right, you know, get that kind of background knowledge right, then you can kind of experiment. You know, if you know how to make a sponge, you can make it with elderflower and gooseberry cream one day, you can make it with raspberry cream the next day, you could put it, you know, with some mango and coconut if you want something else. So, you know, once you get the basic recipes down, then you can kind of start experimenting with your flavours and your different tastes and stuff. And I write an article every week in the Irish Examiner, and the feedback I get from people is brilliant. Like, they just, you know, especially young people, actually get some really, you know, young people who are tasting and trying different things and asking, can they do this and can they do that? And I love just the idea of teaching and helping and showing young people to get into the kitchen, and baking is sometimes an avenue in to cooking as well within kitchens. So it's just a really nice stepping stone for people.
Oh God, I'm getting hungry listening to you. Ellie, what about you? What about favourite recipes or you're from Malawi. Do you bring a bit of that in as well to the Irish thing? Because you studied in Ballymaloe. You mentioned Doreena there earlier, Doreena Allen, who's been a great support to our table. So any tips for people who might want to experiment a bit?
Yeah, one pot meals are fantastic. And, you know, like, I love cooking and I'm a mass cooker. Ask Michelle. I hate to cook for two people. I hate to cook for five people.
Ellie cannot cook for two people. I'm just, she, like, I know it's the, she, Ellie, like, we kind of say, oh, let's have lunch. And there's literally, I'm not kidding you, enough food for nearly 100 people. Like, I know you're saying that's how you grow up and that's your background. And in Africa, it's an idea of cooking a big pot of food and everyone comes to your house and shares and tastes. But it's so funny. I'm like, Ellie, there's only like four of us here for lunch. And it's a beautiful, a wonderful trait. So
yeah, so I love to do that, and I love to make the whole table look colorful, because like that's how our cooking is. So you have like pumpkin cakes, you know, pumpkin donuts, you have mashed pumpkins, you have nice barbecue charcoal chicken, and you have some nice paellas and corn free, lots of food.
Ellie, can I come to your house? Please.
Lots of food. You know, like the good thing about like Malawian cooking or Southern African cooking, you can use the whole table with like maybe 12 different meals with one ingredient. So you have pumpkin and you can make pumpkin out of like 10, 20 meals from that. So that's a good thing about that. And I love doing that. And one also thing that I loved being in Ballymaloe was kind of like, it gave me the sense of setup of back home, being on a farm, waking up every morning, going to the garden, pick up fresh ingredients, vegetables, tomatoes, and whatever it is, and bring them in the kitchen. And you know, like everything has got a touch of the love from that mama's essence, you know what I mean? So that's another thing that I've really loved. And that's where my cooking, it's almost based. So it's almost based from organic, fresh ingredients, and, you know, like get them into the kitchen. And I'm actually learning quite a lot now, you know, like because my cooking was just like salt, spice and this. But now I'm learning a lot of like trying to measure ingredients and all of that and bringing the flavors and stuff like that. So, you know, like that's type of like my cooking.
I'm also going to request a place at your table. So whenever, you know, whenever you're doing that cooking for the masses again, throw my name in the pot, which sounds like it's a very big pot. Yeah. Aoife, just finally to you. I mean, Taste of Dublin will be running a bit differently. There's going to be pods of four or six people, very socially distanced, making sure people keep safe. There's a lot of different restrictions. But at the same time, and it is a really incredible event for showcasing the best of Irish food and bringing all these brilliant providers together. So are you looking forward to it from that point of view, and what can people expect?
Absolutely. I mean, I think they've taken lots of steps this year to make sure that it is safe. So it will be a bit different, but I don't think that's going to take away from the enjoyment of it at all. And I think there's a lot of new things, as Michelle was saying, like, you know, there's going to be lots of different talks and lots of conversations around different aspects of Irish food. So it's not, you know, I think a few years ago it was very much focused on, you know, restaurant stalls, and, you know, they were, you know, obviously showcasing their food. But I think it's gone further than that now, and we've gone a step beyond, and it's more about other kind of aspects of the food industry. And it's so exciting to really just showcase all of that and bring it to kind of one place.
Okay, well, I think you've all described it really well and made me very hungry. I think Taste of Dublin's fantastic, and it's great, like you said, that, like, Michelle, you're going to be doing those food talks. You're now into food education. That's where you've moved. Just finally then, in terms of food education and how we're talking about food now, do you think it's an exciting time in terms of getting back to what's really important in the food industry?
I think it's a really exciting time, and I think it's a time that we can make change. Ireland is a small enough country that we can kind of maneuver our way around and make change. And I think there's a huge interest in where food comes from because of the pandemic, also because of Brexit and how borders might change and how transport of food might change. I think people are looking a little more locally. I've been working with Green Schools and we've developed a food flag for schools. So it's a 2-year food education program that really embeds where food comes from in the first year. So the children get out in the garden, they grow, they test the soil, they measure the plot. So it's bringing in all the sciences and food, and the feedback from the kids has been amazing. And then the second year, they come in and they start looking at food globally. So looking at packaging and food air miles, and they start kind of assessing all the food that comes in and out of their school and start looking at different ways of maybe making their lunches. So it's a really, really interesting time. And I think the parents are really behind it, particularly at the moment now, just seeing how the world is changing. I think how we eat and how we've how our food system is developed over the next few years is going to be integral to things like climate change, sustainability, even activism for young people. You know, that there is a huge interest, particularly in kind of early, late primary, early secondary school. I find the children of that age are hugely interested in how their food affects the environment, and they're looking at ways that they want a better future, they want a different future, and they're asking questions. And I think food education is a way of providing those questions and teaching children the very basics of how to cook. You know, so we're starting at the basics about chopping an onion, sauteing an onion. We've loads of chefs on board that come into schools, and they will do the, we provide a kit, so we provide a cooking kit in the school, and then they just start working the basic recipes, like a pasta sauce that, you know, you can use, and you can use it to top pizza, you can use it to toss your pasta in. And it's just building up the confidence about, you know, adding a little bit of salt, how to season, so the skills around being comfortable in a kitchen, how to use a grater, how to use a peeler, you know, when a child knows all of those things and loses that kind of scaredness of the, I'm sure that's not a proper word, but you know, it loses that kind of nervousness around using those implements, they relax so much more and begin to enjoy it. And then parents can relax because the children kind of start knowing what they're doing. And I think just getting children in the kitchen, getting them knowing where their food comes from, and I just think just getting that pleasure and enjoyment, and not telling children in a didactic way what's good and bad. And I'm not a big fan of telling them what's calories and what's, you know, anything. I'm much more about just getting out there, getting into the garden, getting into the presses, you know, tasting the food, cooking with the food, and just really learning to enjoy food. And I think once you enjoy it, everything else comes much, much easier. You know, the healthiness and the diet and the enjoyment can all kind of feed in together.
And I just want to finally bring you in, Aoife, because you've said you've gone into nutrition. So I imagine what Michelle is talking about there in terms of food education is resonating with you.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it really is the kind of the nutrition for younger people is what I'm more interested in. And I suppose that's why I went into it. I think, you know, health and children, it's something that we definitely need to look at. And I, as a chef, you know, giving them those skills from such an early age is definitely going to benefit them. Like, you know, it's such an important thing that we need to be looking at. And I suppose the nutrition part, yeah, it's really interesting for me, but I think nutrition for children and, you know, really just kind of teaching them about food, where it comes from, you know, not loading them up with sugar every day, but like, you know, just teaching them about good food, wholesome food, where it comes from. As Michelle said, exactly the same, you know, it's so important to just have, you know, those conversations and really just give them the kind of skills that will help shape their cooking going forward and, you know, making them comfortable with food and you know, having an enjoyable experience with it will definitely kind of help them going forward, you know.
And well, speaking of loading people up with sugar, Aoife, which you do every week with your Irish Times piece, what has been the most popular thing that you've written about in the Irish Times so far that you've kind of just everyone's loved and wanted to make?
It's probably one of the first recipes I wrote last year, which was a savoury scone. It was an apple, cheddar and thyme scone. And it was around this time, I think it was, yeah, September last year. And I, in my garden, I had this apple tree and I just thought, what am I going to do with all of these? You know, you get sick of making the apple tarts every year, giving them out to the neighbours. So I just thought, oh, I actually love a scone. And I love a savoury treat as well. Not, it doesn't always have to be sweet. But I think that one was quite popular, yeah.
Okay, you went a bit viral with that scone, as I remember, I think.
Viral, I wouldn't say that, Roisin, but It's an interesting combination of flavors, and it's just a different kind of a different flavor for a scone, you know.
Okay, well, if anyone goes to irishtimes.com and searches up that apple savory scone by Aoife Noonan, they'll be able to find it and recreate it. Thank you so much, all of you, for talking about it. And as I said, I'm very hungry. I'll go and find something, scrabble around in my kitchen, and good luck to you all at the Taste of Dublin, and thanks for coming on the Women's Podcast.
Thanks, Roisin. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That was Ellie Kasyumbi, Michelle Darmody and Aoife Noonan there, and thanks very much to them. And you can find out all about Taste of Dublin. Go and Google it, tastefestivals.com. That's all we have time for. The podcast is produced by me, Roisin Ingle, by Suzanne Brennan and Jennifer Ryan, with JJ Vernon on sound. Contact us on social, on Instagram, Facebook or Twitter, using @ITWomen's Podcast. We're on email too, thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com, and we love hearing from you, so do get in touch. Until the next time, mind yourselves, and thanks very much for listening.